what that does to you, but I've seen that numerous times, and that just something stirs deep within. Cycle of life, right? I trust that's none of our story, though. It's an honor again for me to be here this morning, and I look at faces that I recognize, some of you, and in fact, when I was talking to a few of you downstairs, I wasn't sure why I'm up here, because some of you would be much better at doing this. And I'm right in the trenches right now, and that made me ask another question: what am I doing? As I was preparing for this again, thinking about, I'm on. The light's on. Thinking about the call that we have as men. But I am excited. I felt, you know, there's something about being together as men. You feel that brown ooze flowing from one man to the other. When I was downstairs, I could kind of feel that. And I like that feeling. And seeing all you men at 5:30 out here this morning, and not just this morning, but knowing that you're doing it every morning, every Tuesday morning, when you don't get snowed out, you're leaving a message. And we'll talk about that a little bit this morning. A powerful message about what it means to be who God is calling us to be as men. And it's not something we package and, you know, put in a bottle and cap it and say, this is the way you do it. At least I've never figured that out. But it's something to do about learning and growing and changing, and learning and growing and changing, and learning and growing and changing, and moving and opening up our hearts. I want to start this morning with giving you maybe this is an advertisement. I don't know. This is just something else that you can do, something we do at Life Ministries. By the way, I have 3 boys, 18 in 2 days, he'll be 18, and 16, then 2 girls, and then a 9-year-old son. And, you know, I saw that 9-year-old son, and I saw the college kid, the college young man. And I don't think he's quite like that, but he's sure experiencing. In fact, here in a few weeks from now, he's heading for Bible school. And it's the first time we're sending one out, you know. But we're right in the trenches right now, and I just want to put in this disclaimer this morning. I sure, as I stand before you, I don't have a lot of answers. But I do know who does, and I do know men who have walked the road ahead of me. And if there's one thing I want to make sure that you hear me say, and I'll probably say it a few times, that one of the most important things for me has been to find other men that I see have walked the road ahead of me. And they've done some things right and well, and there's been a broken spirit about them that I say, you know, I want to learn from that. Because we're not all going to do it right or perfectly, but we sure can learn from each other. We do a father-son retreat at Life Ministries every summer. And it's very intense from Thursday afternoon to Saturday afternoon. And we pack it full of a lot of initiatives, games, fun stuff. And literally when everybody leaves by Saturday evening, everybody's wore out. But most of the time they feel good on the inside. Really good, because there's been some connection here, just some shots of what we do. The guys do all the cooking, but fathers and sons work together. The goal is to have the fathers and sons spend as much time together as possible. So we do initiatives together. They cook together. There you see the one gentleman that's here this morning, Harlan. This is down at Camp Andrews. We take the guys down there, and Phil takes us through the ropes course on Saturday morning. There's another shot there at Camp Andrews. But it's where we do things that stretches the guys, and then we break them up. One of us takes the fathers and somebody else takes the boys, and we sit together and we try to talk about it. What's it like for you to do this kind of thing with your son? The other day I was talking to a father, and he had a son that he's really struggling with, and we're looking at the big picture of life. And then I just said to him, I told him about what we do. And he started getting nervous. And he said, "Sam, you have to understand, I've never spent time alone with my son." I said, "What?" He said, "Never spent time like that alone. You're talking about getting up in the morning and going out for Bible study, just to spend a half hour together." Yeah, he said, "I don't know about that." As we've continued talking, I realized he really needs to be there. You know, I really need to get him to come. So if you have any interest to come, just call the office and sign up, and we'll try to get you there. You have to tent it. We rough it, but it is intense. It's a lot of fun. We push the guys, and then we break him up and let him talk together. This morning, fathers and sons, in your manual, it's number 22. And again, I just want to say to you, I am in the trenches, and I am learning, and I'm growing, and I'm open to any feedback from you that you have, that you want to talk to me about afterwards, or even, you know, I say to some of the men that I know well and I respect well, Dan Beachy, a few men at the church that rub shoulders with my sons, youth leader advisors. I've told them, I beg of you, if you see things in my sons' lives, or I'm open, because I'm here to learn and to grow, and I need all the help I can get. I say to my father-in-law when he becomes, my dad passed away in 99, I say to my father-in-law many times that whenever you come, I really respect and I love when you spend time with my sons, and if you take them out. And oftentimes my father-in-law and mother-in-law will take them out just for an hour, half hour. When we're up in Canada, they'll take them out on the canoe or down to the rocks just to hear their grandchildren's hearts, one-on-one. And I love every minute of that. Last year, they took him out to Timmy Hortons up there. At that time, they did it as a group of their grandchildren. Because I want what I'm trying to say to my sons, I want it to be reinforced by the men in their lives that they look up to and to speak into their lives. Because the more that they hear, the more it reverberates within their mind and their heart. I just believe it's going to stick more. They need to hear those things. There's three types of parenting this morning. You have to determine what kind you are and the trenches that you're in. By the way, right off the top, I just want to ask this question. How many of you are just young married and you don't have any sons yet? How many of you don't have any children at all? One, two, okay. Well, I have six books. And it's just these little booklets by John Eldridge. You have what it takes to raise sons, and you have what it takes to raise daughters. I had two boys, and then Amy came. And when Amy came out of, I was there when she came out of the womb, something stirred deep within me that I hadn't felt with my two sons the first 3-4 years of their lives. This protective, nobody's going to take advantage of, you know, the dad thing came alive within me. I'll remember that, and I'll often think about that when I look at my daughters. But he talks about what boys, and it's just a little booklet, men don't like to read, but this is not so big that you can't read this. So six of you guys that don't have any sons and daughters yet, you come up here afterwards and grab one of these books, okay? You have what it takes. I like what John Eldridge says. They're free to you. So you can get off and running on the right pitch. My second son just started driving the other day. He got his permit. And, you know, when you sit beside somebody, and you've been driving for many years, it encapsulates to me, really, what's happening between father and son. There's so many times you can speak into it. There's so many times when you can just let it happen. You know, questions like, why are you going so fast? Why are you going so slow? Did you notice the... You know, in training, they tell you that when you drive, just when your son is getting his license to drive, they say, no, the best thing to train is to take your son out in the car, and as you go through town and as you're doing this, you know, driving, talk out loud as you're driving, thinking, you know, why are you slowing down? What am I doing? I'm looking in the mirror before I turn left. talk out loud so they hear and they think the process is through. And then have them do the same thing when they get behind the wheel. So he was driving and I was beside him, and I, you know, there's so many things I could say. There's so many things I shouldn't say. Because I need to let him find his way and to learn and to grow. Reminds me of a father and a son. A son just got his driver's license and he came home and said, "Dad, we need to talk about the car." Dad said, "Really?" He said, "Yeah, I think it's, you know, like, when do you get the keys and when do I get the keys?" Dad said, "Well, there's three things that need to happen. First thing is when you get your C's up to B's. When you do a little bit more Bible study," he said. "And the third thing is when you cut your hair." "Ah," son said, "I'm not sure about that." And finally said, "Okay, Dad, you have a deal." 6 weeks later, father came to the son and said, "You know, I saw your grade card. You've moved up. You're doing well. And I noticed you've been having Bible study. Lots. You're doing well. But you haven't cut your hair. Why haven't you been cutting your hair?" And the son said, "Well, you see, Dad, I've been reading the Bible. And I noticed John the Baptist had long hair. Then I was over in the Old Testament and Samson had long hair. You know, Moses had long hair, and I even think Jesus had long hair." And the son was feeling like he had really trumped it with his dad. And dad, wise old dad, just shook his head and said, "Yeah, that's right. And they also walked a lot." Sometimes we have to have a lot of wisdom, don't we? Three styles of parenting. The first style is the absent parenting, the absent father. The absent father simply says, and it's an epidemic today, there's over 40%, I see statistics from 40 to 50% that children today, by the time they're age 18, they will either be in a single parent or a step family situation. Now we know that some of those, maybe 10%, are for legitimate reasons, good reasons, right reasons. But there's a big percentage of them because of divorce and because of the sinfulness of fathers and mothers that there's absent families today, absent children because of that. But I really believe that as big a sin as that is, there's just another one as big. The other 52% or 55% of families where the dads are there, the dads aren't there. And those are the ones that I want to talk to you about, because in this kind of setting here, this is where you and I are going to struggle, being absent. And the absent father, really, he's just not there. He just isn't there. We have this video at Life Ministries called Dear Distant Dad. And it's about stories of about five or six young people, 16, 17, 18 years old, where they did interviews with them, and all of their fathers had left. Some were present, but some weren't present. And as they did these interviews, they started asking the kind of questions that pulled at their hearts. And said, if you could, in fact, they had them write letters, and then they read them, what they would like to say to their dads. Gut-wrenching. And these young men and these young ladies, as they read their letters, longing for their fathers, the heart of their fathers. Maybe I should have showed that this morning instead of speaking. But the reality is I don't want to major on the negative or the hard side this morning. I want to bless you and encourage you and enable you, because we need each other to encourage each other so that we're not absent dads. He said that back in the 50s and 60s, and even before that, but it used to be that the dads were at home. They were on the farms. They were, you know, they worked around home a lot. And so the family system was in place. And then in the 30s, 40s, and especially after the war in the 50s and 60s, the industry, factories were booming, and dads were gone from home. And there, it was a big change for the family systems in the United States, and children struggled. But then, the women's movement came, and the 70s started shifting, and the 80s and the 90s, and where we're at today, both dads and moms are gone. And the author of this material says that he doesn't think we have seen the epidemic of what's going to come out. There's one thing to have dad missing at home. There's another thing to have both dad and mom missing at home. Children coming home from school day after day without dad and mom at home, making life work on their own, trying to resolve conflict, you know, without parental supervision. Absent fathers. I think of people that are sports figures that we look up to and admire and, you know, good stuff, but they're very rarely at home. Seldom are some of the people that we, you know, think that they live this glamorous life. It's very difficult. And when on occasion I hear men retire from a sport or saying it's not going well, I need to do something different, I want to be with my children as they grow up. There's just something that comes alive and saying, yeah, we need to hear that message. And especially from men who have a lot of space out there, that they're noticed and recognized. The second kind of father is the engaged father, engaged parenting. And it's the kind of dad that takes his dad to the ball games. He says, you know, I know it's not working to leave my son at home, not to be involved in his life. I'm going to get involved in his life. And they get involved in his life. And he says, son, what do you want to do? You want to play baseball? Okay, I'll take you to your ball games. He sits in the stands and he takes him to his next event and he's with them. But they're always out doing stuff. It's better than not being there at all. As I get older, I value family more and more. I grew up in a family where that was important. I married into a family where it's extremely important. And one of the things I'm trying to establish within my family, with my children, is the importance of the nucleus of family. I just think there's so much value in what can be handed down and what can be modeled and mentored through our family system. When I go back to Ohio during the summer, and I have 7 siblings, and we get together as a family, there, most of them are married, and they have lots of children. I guess I'm just amazed how often in the middle of the party, on Sunday afternoon or Saturday evening, when we get together as a family, you know, one of the dads is pulling out with his son to take him to a ball game. Or they come at 8:30 in the evening because the son had a ball game at 7 o'clock. Now, I'm speaking from a personal level, but I feel this deeply, and so I'm going to say it. And if you have some response to it, or you don't agree with me, but there's something being modeled by my family system that really concerns me. Because at some level we're saying, this and your sports and what you're doing is more important than when the family gets together. And I don't know where the boundaries is. I don't know how to draw that line. But this engaged parenting, this engaged fathering, is a good thing, but it's not as good as it can get. There's better things we have to offer our children. And it's not just in sports. It can be in other categories where, you know, what do we protect within our homes? Do we protect the supper table? In 1950, they had done a study of the American home. How long do they spend around the supper table as a family? 90 minutes. In 1996, they redid that study, or did another study. Guess how long the average family spends around the supper table? 20? 12. 12 minutes. I forget how many were in the study. 12 minutes. And there's so many good things that happen around a supper table. Especially when dad has been over here all day, and the children have been over in school, and the oldest sons or daughters are out working, You know, and they all come back together. Do they all come back together? You know, 12 minutes later? Or is there time? They did another study of fathers and how much time they spend in a week's time with their sons. The average father spent 7 minutes a week with his sons. 7 minutes. According to my calculations, that's about a minute a day. One-on-one time. Average. And I just think we can do better than that. And when I say that, I'm talking to myself. You know, there's moments in our schedule that for 2-3 days, it doesn't allow. But then do we compensate and do we recognize that because we're engaged or we're intentional as dads? And that takes us to the next category, strategic parenting, strategic fathers. Strategic parenting or fathers, they think and they're pondering and they're listening because their goal is to equip their son or their daughter for the most important issues in life. So when they go out in life, they can go out in confidence. They're what they call dads of destiny because they see into the future, they see the big picture of what really matters and what's important. And it's so easy, I think, for all of us as men. I think I'm normal. It's easy for us as men to get focused on today's and tomorrow and this week. And sometimes we lose focus of what are we really pushing into for 1 year from now, in 2 years from now, in 5 years from now. Recently, in one day's time, actually in back-to-back, I had two dads sitting in front of me. And the first dad said to me, I have a son. He's just preteen. He's getting close, you know, he's tall for his age. But he said, Sam, I don't know what's wrong. He constantly wants me to hold him yet at home. And whenever, you know, I'm sitting on the couch, he slides up tight to me and he still wants to rub close to me. And when I'm standing and talking with another man, he likes to stand right against me. You know, he's kind of standing right here. And he just likes to feel me, you know. He said, what's wrong with him? I said, nothing. Next man came in. And his story was completely opposite. He said, Sam, I can't reach my son. I try to, you know, say, do you want to go out and play catch? Pitch and catch? No, Dad, I don't think so. It wasn't a college student. This is a 12-year-old. Two boys, same age. Two fathers saying, I don't know how to touch. I don't know how to reach my son. I tell you, these are the kind of situations, and you all fit somewhere in the middle of that if you're parenting this morning, if you're fathering. The question is, how are we going to move into to be able to touch our sons in deep, meaningful ways? To be who God has called us to be dads of destiny. Proverbs 17:6 says, the glory of sons is their fathers. The glory of a 2, 4, 6, and 8-year-old son is his father. Because we're shaping and molding. But as they become teenagers, you know, the perfect dad and the dad that could do no wrong, it begins to shift a little bit. But the greatest key to the destiny of our sons, we hold. We really do. They're as a teenage, you know, a little boy growing up, he's close to mom. He likes mom. He likes mom to read. But somewhere in the 8, the 10, the 12-year-old range, they begin to pull away from mother. And 14, you know, and a good mom will release their son. And they won't try to hang on and stay attached and create this messy situation where it creates dynamics in the son's masculine identity. But for a father, a son is always measuring himself up against his father. Wanting, even though it's from a distance at times, wanting to observe to see where his dad is at. What does his dad think? Well, as he does that, there's three things that we need to be as fathers to our sons. And they use this metaphor of volleyball, playing the game of volleyball. I like it because it epitomizes for me how we as fathers are called in three categories to be there for our sons. The first one is called, and the ingredients of this strategic father is called, that we're called to be the dig. It's dad's compelling character. Recently, I saw a study of CEOs in our countries and pastors who have failed in their churches. They did this study of leaders in our country, good men. And they broke it down into three categories. They were men, did they have the vision? They were men, did they have the clarity, or were they able to express with clarity their vision? And the third thing about these men, were they able to embrace when people gave them feedback? Did they have the maturity or the depth to have feedback from the employees or the management right underneath them or the assistant pastor or somebody within the church? 80% of all these CEOs and pastors and leaders that failed, good men, wasn't because they didn't have vision, wasn't because they didn't express or with clarity speak their vision, but it was because they weren't able to receive feedback and they weren't able to embrace what others had to say to them. And they became defensive and reactionary and they weren't successful. Well, I'm looking at a bunch of CEOs this morning. If you are going to raise a family, you're going to have to be a CEO in the game of life. You're going to have to be a business manager, a financial wizard. You're going to have to be able to have some things in place to know how to utilize time well, what's important, what isn't important, make choices of where we go, how much we do of what. How do we move in and speak words of life? Recently, a few months ago, we had some families, some couples there at Life Ministries, and we watched the Love and Respect video series together. How many of you have seen that Love and Respect video series? You know what I'm talking about, Emerson Eggerichs. And it's so rich, so deep what he has to say. And I wanted my children to see it. How are you ever going to get children to watch a marriage video, 6-7 hours? And so we talked about it. And I told them, he's funny. You're not going to get bored. He's funny. And we'll have a lot of fun. And they agreed. So we got away for 2 days. And together we watched the Love and Respect video series. Now, my sons thought it, there was moments when it's kind of weird and boring. My daughter at 14, she just loved it. It's about relationships and moving in. The reason I say that is, again, I'm looking for ways for them to hear and to move in, to understand the importance or the hard work it takes if they're ever going to move into marriage. And maybe some of the things that I've been trying to teach will resonate a little bit deeper. Again, as they think about the things that Emerson is saying, he says it so much better, but he says it in a way that's, okay. Well, ever since then, there's these lines that Emerson uses that gets thrown around in our house. Did I step on your air hose? I don't feel respected right now, my son says. Did I do something that offended you? If they can understand actually those principles, it's going to be so helpful for them in the game of life, teaching and training. The dig, it's talking about dad's compelling character. More important than anything else, when the chips are down, what stands out to your sons about who you are as men? Some time ago, I was sitting with a man who trucks. He's a truck driver, and he's gone for up to a week at a time. And he makes a lot of money, pretty good money. And I said, how are the rules with the trucking industry? And he said, well, and he scratched his head and he looked down and he said, well, that's another story. He had four sons. There's more caught than taught. I'm daily aware of that in my life. A new book just came out called Derailed. It's written by Dr. Tim Urban. Derailed. And he talks about the reason why leaders get derailed. It's because they're not willing to have this kind of character. He says that character always trumps competence. And when we minimize character, it derails us in the game of life. There's so much more I could say about dig, but we set. The next one is, you know, in volleyball, when somebody slams, you got to go down and get it. That's the dig. The next one is now, you're going to set up your sons so that they can be winners in life. How do we set our sons? It's dad's clear instruction, where there's no doubt what's being taught, no doubt the direction, the plan ahead. Some time ago, we had a father-son retreat in our church, and Dan Beachy, who's administrator there, his two sons, and Dan spoke at our retreat. Halfway through the seminar, the weekend, his two sons were speaking. And they said there came a time in their lives when at 16 and 17, somewhere in that age, when they had questions or, you know, they wanted to do something and they wanted to talk to dad about it, they go to dad and say, "Dad, what do you think about this? Or, you know, is it okay if we go do this here?" And they said with a lot of pride and a lot of security, they say, "Dad would look at us with kind of this quizzical look. And said, you know what I think. Now what do you think? Let's talk about what you want to do with that." That was his pattern. At 16 and 17, I've talked to him about that. I said, "Why weren't you concerned about them making choices, you know?" He said, "Well, they did sometimes. You know, sometimes they'll make choices where you have to wiggle your toes and say, 'Whoa, did I do the right thing?'" But he said, "That's where they learn, and that's where we learn together." And so the set is, by 15, 16, 17, be able to say, "Well, you know what I think. You know what Mother and I have been trying to teach you. Now, what do you want to do? Why do you want to do what you want to do?" There's three things our sons need to hear over and over again. The first one is, you know, I have a 9-year-old, he's my youngest now, and sometimes when I feel really close to him, I just like to get up, you know, he loves to wrestle on the floor, all boys do, right, and roughneck and that kind of stuff, but sometimes I just like to look him right in the eyes, and I say, "Trenton, you know, I love you so much, you know, make," and it's so intense that he kind of giggles and he looks away, and then I'll take his head and I make him look at me. And then he'll look at me and he just smiles and he drinks it in. Sons need to hear dad say, "Son, I love you." When we say "son," we're saying, "You're mine. You're mine. And I love you." And the best time to say "I love you" is not when you've just had a blast with them, or not just when things are going well, but the best time is when they've dropped the ball, where you can say to them, "Son, I love you. Whatever happens, or whatever you choose to do, you'll never be able to take away my love for you." They also need to hear the set, where you're saying, "I'm proud of you." Now, some of you might react a little bit to that. "I'm proud of you." But I really believe that. Because if they don't hear it from dad, they're going to try to find it and hear it from some other source. "Son, I'm proud of you. I like the choices you've made." I tell you, my sons are far from perfect, but they're making choices at 16 and 17 that I never dreamt of when I was that age. I was way out here, and I made a lot of mistakes in those teenage years going into my 20s. I really blew it. I was a 3-time loser. I'm not proud of it. I brought a lot of shame to my family and a lot of shame to my dad. But God has given me the opportunity to try to redeem some of that time. But when I see my sons make good choices, I like to say to them, you know, you're making choices way ahead of what your father ever did, and I'm proud of you. The set. The third thing is, son, you're good at. You're good at, and you fill in the blank. If it's sports, if it's hunting, if it's writing, if it's music, if it's working, whatever, with their hands, you're good at. They need to hear that from us as fathers. A good friend of mine, raised in the same culture that I was, not long ago, he's been writing and writing and writing, and he's been longing to be able to get his stuff published. His dad was a prolific writer in his circles, and the son has the same kind of traits his father does. And he longed to be able to get his material published. And he got it out to the different publishers, and nothing was happening, nothing was happening. He gets a call from Tyndale. Tyndale's big, you know, it's huge. They said, we want to write your book, we want to write your story for you. And so he's telling me all this stuff, you know, he just signed the contract, and he was pumped. And I knew his relationship with his father, and I knew what he wanted. His dad is old today. And I said, anybody that you're really looking forward to telling? He put it in his blog, you know, and his face changed, and his demeanor changed, and he said, yeah, I'll tell my dad. He's old today. And I said, how are you going to tell him? He thought for a little bit. He lives in another state. He's far away. He said, well, I haven't decided yet. But what I want to do is I want to tell him face to face. Why? What did he want to hear from his dad? I'm talking about an old, old man to a man my age. The man my age wrote the book. Dad's clear instruction is part of the set. And finally, it's the spike. That's where, when we set them up, and then we, at some point, really nail it in good. We put it in real hard for them, where, without a doubt, they know that they know that they know. That, and that's called the ceremony, that they know that we're blessing them. It's the blessing. And let me say four things about the blessing, five things. First of all, the blessing is Dad's creative memories. Memorable ceremonies are costly. I'm talking about a specific event at some point in their life where they know that they're becoming men. In the Jewish culture, the Hebrew culture, as it was four or 5,000 years ago, it's still true today that they have a very specific event at the age of 12 for their sons. This spring we had the opportunity to spend 3 months in Israel. We spent different times. We were up in Nazareth those 3 months, but we had some time in Jerusalem. And you know, when you go to Israel and you're on a tour, you only have a little bit of time here and a little bit, but we had time in Jerusalem 6 days. One time we went and stayed in the Old City for 6 days. My favorite spot in the Old City was to walk down to the Western Wall. In the morning, in the afternoon, in the evening. It's a huge area there. It's like a large square. And over there is the Western Wall. And this large square, there's always just lots of people from lots of different nationalities and ethnic groups. It's just kind of where people come. But one of the things we saw almost every day when we were there is a bar mitzvah. It's where a 12-year-old son is now going, they're going to celebrate his manhood. And they come in to the Western Wall area there with pomp and passion. And they'd have this little 6x6 little umbrella or little tent, four posts. And there'd be a man on each one of the posts, and slowly they'd be walking. And the 12-year-old on his father's shoulders was in the middle. And there's a big group around him, and they were singing and chanting and dancing, and they had these big horns that they would blow, beautiful. And everybody around, you know, you'd stop and you'd look and you'd listen. And this celebration went on and on. And they go down and they form a circle there and dance, and the sun was in the middle, and they would be dancing around him, and they'd hold him up, and then, now for my sons and I, and a Baptist, it looked pretty radical. But you know what? I know a boy, every time I saw that, I see a boy, he'll never forget this event. Sometimes they just kind of all stop. And I don't know if they're rabbis or, you know, but three of these men would just, or four, just rear back on these long, you know, and blow these things. And it would just ring. Powerful. Everybody look. This 12-year-old son being there. Memorable ceremonies are costly. You throw a big party when you have an event like this. It brings value to the person being celebrated. Why do you go to weddings? Why do you go to graduations? To remember. It brings value to them. We want to celebrate with you. This is an important event. Well, when you, next Tuesday morning, last week, I was invited to a friend of mine. He was having a celebration for his son, a blessing time. Next Tuesday morning, I'm again at 5 o'clock in the morning to another man who wants to do that for his son, inviting some of his best friends together. I've done it with two of my sons. And by the way, this is exciting. I just read recently where fathers are now doing it for their sons after they're married and they just had their first grandchild, or the son had his first baby. And because he's never had children before, you know, I say to Matthew, you've been my guinea pig. You're my guinea pig, you know. I've never had a teenager before. I never had, you know, an 18-year-old. I don't know how to do it well. Trenton, my 9-year-old, I'll work through some things a little bit. You know, I would do things differently with Matthew today if I would have had that capacity. I think I took it too serious. But now they're starting, and I look forward maybe to do that with my sons, to have blessing times when they have their first child, and getting men together and saying, let me just pour some stuff in, you know, let me just speak into what it might look like for you. This is some of the things that I wish I would have known. Value to the person being celebrated. Ceremonies employ symbols. Doing something, buying something that represents. I was at one here not long ago, and the father had bought a long sword. That was what he gave to his son at his blessing time. By the way, if you've not done it, and your son is 20 or 25, you can still do it. I did it with my 13 and at 14. Memorable ceremonies involve others who are significant to the person being celebrated. I don't have any brothers in this area. Kathy doesn't have any brother. Well, she didn't have any. She had four sisters, but brother-in-laws. And so when I wanted some of my uncles, my son's uncles, to be here. And I really wanted grandpa to be here when I did this with my sons. And I told my brothers, you know, if you come out, I'll pay your gas. I don't, you know, it's costly. I said to my sons, what kind of, you know, what would you like to do? And the one said, well, could we, if I'm going to have my friends here, could we rent the gym? And because he likes basketball. And so we rented Linville. And behind Life Ministries, we built a big fire that night, and we had lots of snow that day. But the men came, and we had straw bales. I went to the neighbor Amish farmer and got his straw bales, and we had straw bales, and my son's friends sat in these straw bales, and six or eight of my father's, the friends, the fathers of my son's friends, they sat over here. I put two logs right up by close to the fire, right in the middle of us. And my son, I called him up and said, can you sit here? And one by one, I asked the fathers to come up and speak words of life to my sons. My other son said, I don't want to have that kind of party. He said, I want to go snowboarding. I said, what? Snowboarding? Yeah, I want to go snowboarding. So at 5 o'clock in the morning, I asked men again to come, and we met at Life Ministries, and we had another. Oh, and by the way, one of the things that's important, you ask them, what do you want to eat? I want to throw the biggest party for you because it's worth it. And you don't tell him it's worth it, you just do it. And so I rented a 15-passenger van. You know, I don't have a lot of money, but if I'm going to spend some money, it's going to be in letting them know that they're becoming men. And after we had a ceremonial time, and Kathy came over to life, and she made a fabulous breakfast, and then my son with his friends piled into a van, and you know, they paid for their snowboarding, but I got him there. But so recently, when I was starting to think about this, two different times I asked my son, this happened 2-3 years ago with the last one, and I said, what do you remember about those times? And for both of my sons, and it's an event, and it's not the most important thing, but it's an important thing. You know, how we live out life, the dig is important, our character, and how we set them. But this spike is important. I said, what stood out to you? What do you remember about that? But they had this pleased look on their face. It was just kind of like, yeah, it was a sweet day, Dad. It was sweet. It was rich. My one son said, you know, I was kind of embarrassed sitting up there and listening to everybody's looking at me as the men would. But I still remember what some of these men spoke. Gave them 2 minutes each. Put a paragraph together, sent it to these fathers and said, would you come and speak into my son's life? Something that will help shape and mold who they are, kind of, you know, cut into the heart. It's the spike. How are we going to raise boys that have a vision, a life with a vision? We have to be creative. We reject passivity. We accept responsibility to lead courageously and believing it all for God's greater reward. So you have to be creative when you do it. There at the end, your son will love it. And I like this photo here. A son graduating from college, and before this, you know, the world, he's saying, thanks, Dad, I love you. You've gotten me this far. His back is, you know, he's heading in this direction. I'm out of here, he's saying. But thanks, Dad, I love you. One more story. A couple years ago, I heard of, I'll make this brief. A couple years ago, I heard of two college sons over in Europe. They were going to travel Europe for the summer. They came into Switzerland, and they heard that there's people who walk up, they hike the Dom. I think it's one of the highest, it's the highest mountain, actually, in Switzerland. It's higher than Mater Dom. It's more famous. But this one's 15,000 feet high. Well, they're adventurous. They're in good shape. They said, we're going to walk this thing. Sunny, beautiful August morning. They wait, not a cloud in the sky, and they take off. They're bold, they're brash. You know, the world is in front of them. They start going up the mountain. Come past the tree line about noonday. Their goal is to get to the high hut. The high hut is about halfway up the mountain. That's where they're going to stop for the night. And and then continue their trek the next day. Their goal is to get to the high hut. The only thing they have is the path. As they come up close to the top of the tree line, they notice that it's starting to get cloudy. But they really didn't know what that meant, and they didn't give much thought to it. And then it starts to sprinkle, and it begins to rain. As they clear the tree line, the timber line, they keep on the path, not prepared, no tents, no nothing against the elements. Hey, it had been a nice, clear morning. Now they're getting soaked, and the temperature is dropping, and they're going to higher altitude, and it begins to get icy. Now they're frozen, and the ice turns to snow, and it gets white, and now they're losing sight of the path. And they realize not only are they cold and wet, they're going to die. Up at the high hut, the Swiss Alpine Club that maintained the high hut, the man that was in charge that night looked outside, and he saw that the weather was getting nasty, and he thought, you know, possibly somebody's out there. Maybe they need some light. So just before he goes to bed, he takes an oil lantern and sticks it outside the door. You're already ahead of me, aren't you? These young fellows who had the world in front of them, lost in the snow and frozen, all of a sudden one sees a light way in the distance, just a little flicker. And they made it to the hut. Sometimes, men, we send our sons out, but what you have given them, what you poured into their lives, is like that light. And they're going to mess up. I sure did. But what you pour into them, or what you keep from them, will make a difference in their lives. Thanks.